Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus 580, hour number two of our show. Glad to have you with us. My name is David Inge. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Freines at the controls this morning. We're pleased to have back here on the program with us this morning in this hour, Dr. Suzanne Truppin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She teaches at the U of I Med School. She has a practice here in our area. And for a long time now, on a regular basis, she has been stopping by to talk about women's health. We can talk a little bit about maybe some of the things that are new or in the news, but the main thing that we try to do with these programs is to have this as a resource for you to be able to ask questions. We've talked about a lot of different things with the doctor here in the past. So whatever might be on your mind, as long as it falls within her area of practice, you can certainly call. And I know she'll do her best to answer your question. The only thing I do try to remind people when we do any show with a physician is that we cannot diagnose over the phone. They cannot. Obviously, there are certain things that they can't do because they cannot see you. We do these programs for the health information that they would contain. And if you have some questions, this is, of course, a great place to ask questions, maybe get some basic kind of information. And then if you have concerns, you want to pursue that with your own physician or someone who can see you. But this is a place that you can start and get some basic questions answered and get some basic information. That's why we do these shows. So having said all that, here's the phone number. It's 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, you can make the call, and it's on us. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
We already have somebody here ready to go, so you want to just go ahead and take
it? Absolutely.
All right. Starting out with someone in Champaign, and this is line number one.
Yeah.
Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
I'm on Prempro, and I'm trying to ease off, so I want to cut my pills in half. I'm on 0.625/2.5. Is that a medication where cutting it in half wouldn't harm the integrity of the pill?
Well, what we normally say that women on hormone replacement therapy should be on the lowest effective dose for the shortest amount of time. The way that women should be transitioned off their hormone therapy usually is recommended to be with medical guidance, so that whoever prescribed that pill probably was giving you medication for some reason. And it may be that at the present time you have no symptoms that you're treating. But as David said, we're not really treating one individual over the phone. We're talking about topics, so that, for instance, some women may be actually taking their hormone therapy because it is protecting their bones and they're on no other therapy for their bones. So if you're going to decrease or halt your medication, will you need to be on something else for your bones? Or do you even know how healthy your bones are? Have you had a recent calcium level or a recent bone density test and so forth?
Fairly recent.
And you know, so.
But you're not answering my question. Is this a pill that you can cut in half?
Actually, with Premarin, it is safe to cut it in half.
Prempro.
But with the Prempro medication, it is perfectly safe to cut those medications in half. But the timing on the release of it is such that it's essentially out of your system fairly quickly within that 24-hour period. So you're going to get a little bit of a different kind of half-life. And again, probably for whatever you're being given, there may be other better ways to transition off that therapy, or perhaps not even necessarily go down to half strength. The intermediate doses of Prempro are in 0.45 doses and 0.3 doses. So many women do better by getting a prescription that goes down to 0.45 first and then transitioning to 0.3. But again, you're going to have to address the issues of what you're trying to treat and if you're becoming symptomatic and how you can be best managed with those symptoms if you are going to become symptomatic.
Well, I've already discussed it with my physician, and she didn't know if it was safe to cut in half.
So oh, okay. I see.
That's why I was asking. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. I guess this is the kind of thing just not just with a medication like this, but I think we'd want to make sure that people were not doing something unless they knew, unless they had discussed it with their
right.
doctor, with the pharmacist, because there are some pills that you can split. And in fact, some people find that you can save money.
Oh, that absolutely. Way. Some are designed that way, and they're formulated in such a way that they can be scored and split. Premarin as a medication, it's got a pretty thick capsule, and which is why some people have trouble digesting it, and that if you want to transition, there's better ways of doing it.
Yeah.
But definitely cutting is what saves you money.
Yeah, right. Although my only experience, this was recently with a veterinary medication where we were doing that, and I guess the one thing I would say was it was extremely difficult to get the pill cut so that you get two equal pieces.
And that is difficult. And for some medications, that makes a big difference. And for some patients, that makes a big difference. And I think that sometimes transitioning to another type of formulation where you can do that, or where more doses are available. We're lucky now because for so many years, we didn't have alternatives, but now we do. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, I'd be surprised if the doctor wanted someone to take a lower dose, they'd call in the lower dose.
Yeah, okay. We have some other callers, in fact, a number of them. Next would be someone listening in Whiteheath, and this is line number two. Hello.
Hi. A few weeks ago, I saw an article in the Chicago Tribune about a problem with the bone drugs that they're giving now, like Fosamax and Actonel and Zometa and some of those, that they are finding people with osteonecrosis. I don't know if you've heard of that problem or not, but they even had a picture of this person's jaw, and it was really, I mean, the person had been on chemo, and so it had caused, they are at greater risk apparently, but I don't know if you've seen this problem coming up in any of your patients or not. I've been on Actonel, and I don't have osteoporosis. I have osteopenia. And then I thought, well, I don't know if this is such a good drug. It's fairly new drug. So
Actonel's been around for quite a while, and the bisphosphonate categories have been around for a long time. And the initial reports of osteonecrosis of the jaw in large numbers came out a few years ago, and it has been a known potential rare but possible side effect of the bisphosphonates as a class. But drugs like Zometa, which are given in high dose intravenously, primarily for conditions that are related to malignancies, are the drugs where it has been reported more commonly, so that the numbers of patients that have gotten this condition that are not cancer patients are extremely rare. But yes, we say we tell patients that it would be very unusual in somebody with good dental health and so forth, so that we do recommend that if you have any symptoms, that they do get checked out. If you have poor dentition to begin with, that you get that checked out. And if you are on long-term therapy and you have a concern regarding your teeth or jaws, that you discuss that. Again, what we try to do now with medication management, and particularly with management of osteopenia, and I think I've talked about this a little bit on the show, that we have a relative risk category where we look at your age, your score, and your 10-year risk of fracture, and try to do medication management based on that, and whether you should be on a few years of therapy and then COAST, because they have shown that with bisphosphonate therapy that your your levels will stabilize, or whether you should be switched on medications, and whether or not I see a lot of patients in consultation that are on hormones and bisphosphonate therapy, and their scores aren't very low. So I try to discourage that medication piling up if the clinical scenario doesn't really warrant it. But it is a known potential side effect, and you should be discussing that with either your dentist or your prescribing physician if you have a concern about your teeth. But it's rare for the average, extremely rare.
They showed this picture, and it was...
The pictures are bad. I've seen the pictures.
Really disgusting.
I've seen the pictures, but no cases, luckily.
Oh, well, I talked to my dentist, and they do have a couple of cases.
Yeah, and dentists luckily, are more likely to get those patients. Now, there are cases of osteonecrosis that are not related to bisphosphonates. So, this is something dentists do see.
Yeah, well, it's something to... I'd be aware of, I think, from my point of view, because every so often drugs, you know, did you think are safe, then they come up, sorry.
It's a risk-benefit analysis that's very important to sit down and do with your own physician.
Yeah.
And patients need more careful calcium monitoring, and many patients aren't getting monitored quite as closely as I would prefer if I was the practitioner. But
yeah. Okay, well... Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks for the call. I guess I don't understand that. Maybe this would be complicated to explain, but how it is that a medication that would be prescribed to try to preserve bone might somehow be related to a disease process.
Excellent.
Where
you've just been doing
bone.
This show too long, David, but they don't really know. But affecting bone turnover is what these medications are designed to do. And our bone has a natural life cycle. And that life cycle involves osteoclasts and osteoblasts and a quiescent period. And when we're in the osteoclast mode, we're chiseling out parts of our bone. And we're doing that so the osteoblasts can come by and deposit new bone. And we're supposed to do that, and it needs to be done periodically to keep your bone healthy. But if you're over chiseling, which most menopausal women are, then this is a potential concern. So what some think as the partial mechanism for how these medications work is they cause a condition called apoptosis. It's a fancy word for cell death. And we're trying to kill off some of those osteoclasts. And so perhaps something about that process gets started in these places. This is a specific condition of the jaw, and the physiology of the jaw bones and the teeth are a little bit different than some of the other areas of the bone. And it may be that when in combination already with, as I said, pre-existing dental disease, that it can cause a problem.
Okay. Is there any recommendation that women who are taking bisphosphonates get any different kind of dental screening than
usual? I haven't read the package insert lately, but as far as I know, it's these conditions are reported under warnings for physicians to discuss with their individual patients. So usually I just, you know, briefly as part of general care discuss where they stand with their general dental care.
Okay. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has practice in our area. She also teaches the UI Med School. And on a regular basis, she is here and we talk about women's health. Questions are welcome. And again, we have several people ready to go. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next is someone in Champaign. This is line number one. Yes, hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I'm on a cell phone, not in Champaign.
Oh, well, pardon me. Well, wherever you are, welcome, and go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I had a couple of questions. These are also related to hormone therapy. One question is, I'm on the Menistar patch, and I've been on it for about a year now, and I understand what we're looking for is the lowest effective dose for the shortest period of time. Is there any data yet about what that period of time is typically? And also, I don't really understand how it's supposed to work if the menopausal symptoms are due to the lack of estrogen, and then replace the estrogen with a patch or pill or whatever, aren't the symptoms just going to come? How is it that the symptoms finally go away? If you went off the patch, wouldn't it just come back? Does the body finally adapt to the lower level of estrogen, or how does that all work together? And I wondered also if you could comment on what the current thinking is about the Women's Health Initiative study, and how that fits or doesn't fit very well with all the previous studies and where we are currently on that. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. That should give you enough to work with for a while.
If I was on your show 2 hours a day for 2 weeks, I may not be able to get all this done, but let me make a stab at it. Okay. We aren't sure what causes all the menopausal symptoms. So if when you're saying what length of time do we treat, again, we back off and say, what are we treating? Are we treating bone problems? Are we treating hot flashes? Are we treating sexual function? Are we treating vaginal dryness? What is it that we're treating? And there are different answers for all those conditions. But since your second part of your question dealt with the hot flashes, the quick answer is we don't completely understand the hot flashes, but the but yes, we do think that the body adapts to lower levels, and we think that there are brain chemicals, particularly in the pituitary, that have their own surges that produce the effects of temperature fluctuations and so forth that do change over time and gradually will adapt to lower levels. For most women, the most intense hot flashes are 2 years prior to menopause, 2 years after menopause, and that if you treat during that time frame for vasomotor symptoms, which is the medical term for hot flashes, you're going to get that condition resolved. However, if you do a population study of women not on therapy, there's even a very small percentage of patients that are still symptomatic up until age 80. So it's not so much, even in some of these patients, of delaying when you go through this as the fact that they're going to still have symptoms for many years. No one has been able to pin the tail on the donkey and say exactly how many years each person is going to need therapy. It really is a case-by-case, year-by-year kind of scenario. And when the Women's Health Initiative first came out and people were, I think, to a large extent, misinterpreting that data, and I'll get back to that in 1 second, but lots of patients were trying to come off of fairly strong doses in very short amounts of time or self-medicating. I got people coming in, they're on these crazy regimens where, well, I take a pill every day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, then I take a third of a pill, and then I take a half a pill, and then I skip it a week, and I don't even know why, but this is what a lot of people are doing. And we found out that some people are very resilient, don't have symptoms, and many women really can't tolerate that. And others come off their medication fairly successfully for long periods of time and then notice a resurgence of symptoms. And we're trying to study that group and figure out what's going on, as well as coming up with complete alternatives. The vast majority of women who are not on any therapy postmenopause in terms of estrogen hormones, somewhere between 5 and 10 years down the line, and for some women it's faster, will get vaginal atrophy. And so we're trying to come up with some of these new selective estrogen receptor modulators to treat the vaginal atrophy without giving a hormone, which there is no treatment. I have two protocols that we're enrolling patients in right now, looking at different alternatives. And just a succinct summary about the Women's Health Initiative. First of all, we haven't heard the last word. Second of all, it's probably a very different physiology for a woman going on hormone therapy as she transitions through the menopause versus a woman like the average woman in the Women's Health Initiative who was age 63 and had gone many years from her menopause without hormone therapy. There's two different animals out there. And I think that the message from the Women's Health Initiative is that hormone therapy is safe. It's very safe. The incidence of problems were very, very low. But the incidence of several important medical problems were much higher than expected. And that given that information, We wanted patients who were no longer in need of the medicine or not in need of the medication to begin with to either not or either to be transitioned off, transitioned to lower doses because we think it's a dose response, or not started on the therapy until they actually need therapy. And I hope quickly that answered all three of the questions.
Okay. And if the caller would like to ask them follow-up, that would be okay too. And we do, in fact, have some other callers as well. So we'll continue and talk next with someone also in, this is someone in Champaign, and it's line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Okay. I am a 73-year-old woman, and I have had bone density tests, and I came at the high end of normal, and have never had problems until the last year or so with my knees. And I have been taking glucosamine with chondroitin for about 15 years. But I just read recently where they say it doesn't do you any good. And I'm wondering, is this the reason probably that I'm having pain, a little bit of pain now? Certainly much more difficulty getting up and down. Much more, I know it's AGE, but also it just seems to have come on kind of suddenly. I do am in an exercise class 3 days a week, and I do leg type and joint type machines. So I'm just wondering, am I on the right path, or is it going to go down pretty fast? I know it's hard to tell, but what about that glucosamine?
Well, you're right. The most recent study on glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate did not show any known medical benefit to those products. And I'm not sure we've heard the last word on them because so many patients do have some symptomatic relief from arthritic type problems. When you get a bone density test, what they're testing for is the thickness of your bones. And they're trying to, from that one test, and there are many other factors that are important, and I think people need to get those tests and understand those tests, but they also need to understand that once they are in case management for a diagnosis, there's more to it than that test. But having said that, that test predicts whether or not you have established osteoporosis. It's not an X-ray. Vertebral fracture analysis done with the newer, more sophisticated bone density machines do help us establish whether or not you have pre-existing osteoporotic fractures of the spine. It's a little bit different. Also, an area that's not thoroughly worked up in many patients. But those tests are designed to predict whether or not you are at low risk, intermediate risk, or high risk of developing an osteoporotic fracture. And those numbers are used to help you decide whether or not prevention or treatment is indicated in your case with medication for the prevention or treatment of osteoporotic fractures. On the flip side, there is a very common condition as we get older that causes aches and pains and joint problems that is more related to inflammation of those joints called arthritis. And that is osteoarthritis is a completely separate entity from osteoporosis, in spite of the fact that if you don't listen closely, they sound almost the same. And it's important to get a proper diagnosis to understand what type of arthritis you have and work with your healthcare provider regarding what is going to be the most successful regimen for you in terms of prevention of joint pain and disability.
Okay.
But it sounds like you're on the right track.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. So the osteo is the word for bone. That's why it's in both of those.
Absolutely.
Words.
So you must have taken some Latin.
Yeah, a little
Not
bit.
That I ever did.
A little bit. So, those things that are taken, that are used to treat osteoporosis, the thinning of the bones, do they not have any effect on osteoarthritis?
I think probably for our purposes, they don't have any effect on osteoarthritis that we know of.
Okay. So it's a different thing.
It starts to get a little complicated when you talk to individual patients or when the patients talk to their individual physicians, because there are, when you do those bone density tests, it shows the areas of osteoarthritis and can actually make some of the interpretations of those bone density tests a little bit in error. And in fact, if you think about it, and it's a little bit complicated, but we're talking about thickness. So if you have a spine that is so fractured that it's all compressed on itself, so you see a little old lady who's, or man, but, you know, it's more common in women, yeah, who's completely hunched over, she might do a spine bone density and have a great score because it's all squished down. Right. So they're just, you know, again, interpretation, and not necessarily over-interpretation. And some people with arthritis get calcium buildups along some of those joints that are near the bones that we're testing, again, producing a falsely elevated score. So correct interpretation. And the International Society for Clinical Densitometry, which covers the interpretation of bone scores, has actually issued a lot of different recommendations that I see aren't always being followed in some of the reports that I view from other radiology departments. And I know locally, I'm certified as, and my techs have taken the classes as well, from the International Society of Clinical Densitometry. And, you know, I apologize if anybody just recently got certified, but I don't think anyone else is in this area. So I think that some of the interpretation varies from place to place.
Okay. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has practice in our area. She also teaches at the U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign. And on a regular basis, she is here on the program, and we talk about women's health. And we have some other folks who have questions. If you'd like to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Someone in LaSalle County is next on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
My whole family has been going to Mayo's intermittently since I was probably 20 years old. And the last time I went, thinking I knew their regime, I had somebody take me up there 650 miles between Christmas and New Year's, thinking I would be able to get in. The message to me was that they would let me know in 2 or 3 months, I think it was. And now that I hit 75 in January, I wrote him a note to say I'm waiting a year later. Have they changed their regime, or do they only deal through doctors, or what?
Oh, I wish I could answer this question. I know that when I do have a patient with a active medical problem that I have to refer, they are very rapid in their response and getting that patient taken care of. Beyond that, for regular examinations, since I don't get my care there, I can't answer the question. But I bet they have patient service lines where you could call and get a direct answer to that.
I wonder if admissions would be a good place.
I think probably any number you call, you just tell them that you what topic you want to discuss. They'll probably get you to the right place.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We'll continue. And the next caller in line would be in Urbana. Line number 2. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm calling for my granddaughter in Florida who was trying to get in on the long-distance line. She's recently pregnant and had to set off flea bombs in her house, and she's really just terrified that she may have done something to her baby, or that specifically. And in general, what do you have to say about the whole pesticide, insecticide thing for pregnant women?
Well, in general, whenever you have a product that you use, there's usually information in the package insert. There's also 800 numbers. But to answer a specific question more quickly, it typically will give you an amount of time to stay away from your house and air out the house. And the chance of exposure to that product is very, very minimal. We know that in the United States, we've had pesticide exposure for a long, long time, and at least clinically, we're not able to pinpoint any specific newer incidence of abnormalities in our children that hadn't been reported at all. So in spite of the overall growing concern, we don't, as a wide group of physicians, have any general recommendations for our population. Now, OSHA health standards, every place of employment has to have information on file of any noxious chemicals of any nature, whether they're pesticides or not, that that the workers might be exposed to, and provide you with information about that. In general, we say don't eat or drink around chemicals. In general, say if we have someone who works with a lot of chemicals, and he, let's say it's the husband, we say when he comes home, wash his clothes separately with other clothes and so forth. Just some basic recommendations. I know there's a couple of good toxicology sites on the website that have a lot of good patient information, as does the FDA, as does the Center for Disease Control. And so if you do a little surfing on the web, you'll probably find a lot of specific information.
Mm-hmm.
But one flea bomb's not going to be harmful.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. We'll continue. I'll go next talk with someone in Tutopolis, right here, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. My name is Jeannie, and I was ruled with arthritis. I have rheumatoid arthritis. But before that, a year or so before that, they just said it was an inflammatory arthritis. And they had me on Naperson for a year. And now they ruled it as a rheumatoid arthritis, and said that it didn't show on blood tests for so long, and that's why it got so as severe as it did. And they put me on Naperson and sulfur and also steroids. And I had gotten off the every time I get off the steroids, the swelling all comes back. And so then I get back on them a while. What is the long-term effect of steroids?
Well, there are potentially many long-term effects, and definitely is something that you should be discussing with your own healthcare provider. There's some both acute effects and long-term effects, so that acutely, if you had to have surgery, there are special ways that you have to be treated. Some people run the risks of more infections, that sort of thing. Long-term, we do worry about bone health. And many of the medicines, some of the bisphosphonates that we were talking about earlier, are indicated for the prevention and treatment of glucocorticoid steroid, meaning induced osteoporosis. But in general, when you're on a group of medications like that with your physician monitoring, what you want to do is sit down and discuss that package insert and risks and benefits, and be sure that you understand what you're going to be monitored for.
Okay. So the methotrexate that I'm on now, evidently I was concerned that it wasn't doing any good, that the only thing that was helping me is the steroids. Once I'm on them, then, you know, after a few days, then I'm fine. There's no swelling, no problem anywhere at all. And I was considering getting off the methotrexate and the sulfur and staying just with the steroids. But
good luck. You're going to have to talk to your own doctor. Okay. That's going to be a little bit beyond something we can do over the radio.
Yes. Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you for your time.
Well, thanks for the call.
Good program.
We have about 15, maybe a little bit more than that, minutes left in this hour of the show with Dr. Suzanne Truppen. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll continue, and we'll talk with some other folks here. Next in line is in Buckley, and that is line number three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Sorry, I've had some fillings this morning, so.
She must want to get this question.
Well, I do. I was wondering if a woman, without going to a doctor, would be able to tell whether she has a yeast infection versus a bacterial infection.
Well, that's a good question, and there have been a number of studies done on that, and based on symptomatology, people are pretty accurate, but not completely accurate. So that if you read the package inserts on yeast that are available, and there are no real treatments for bacterial vaginosis over the counter at this stage, but they will describe the symptoms and say if you're not getting a response, or you've had recurrent quote-unquote infections that aren't responding to what you've been taking, that you should go ahead and be diagnosed. In general, the quickest thing is to know what the pH of the discharge is, but there are lots of ways you can mess that test up. But in general, yeast infection patients have a normal vaginal pH, which is very acidic, and a bacterial vaginosis patient will have a very basic test. So if you use pH paper, acidic, yellow, very basic pH would be more blue. And this pH test, however, won't be accurate if you have atrophic vaginitis. Many of the menopausal patients will have very basic.
Well, I'm not menopausal.
Yeah, but it's probably something that a healthcare provider would have to make that accurate diagnosis for you.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
This is something I know that we have talked about before, because there are some over-the-counter products for yeast infection, and I think that I think some people argue that, say, if you're a woman that unfortunately has that as a recurrent problem, mm-hmm. and you know the symptoms, I think that some women have said, look, I'm pretty sure that this is what this is. If I call the doctor, it's going to take time. I've got to get in there. I've got to get a prescription. Why can't I just go down to the drugstore and buy Monistat or something like that and take care of it myself that way and get treated quicker and feel better quicker and save the visit to the doctor, save everybody's time?
It was very exciting when Monistat was the first product that went over the counter, and many, 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 many years ago, we were involved in that pivotal trial that the FDA looked at to decide whether patients could self-treat. And as we've discussed many times before, there are many conditions in the United States that we don't have access to over-the-counter medication that they do overseas, even birth control pills. But it's interesting. I was even lecturing to a group of college kids, and they didn't think birth control pills should be over the counter. They thought you should go to a doctor and find out about proper use. So even our own population has mixed views about some of these things. But in general, with a condition like yeast, yes, it's quite safe and you can be fairly accurate, but a certain percentage of the conditions are not yeast and sometimes could be more harmful to not get that condition diagnosed and treated. So you need to be aware of whether the therapy is working or not.
Okay. Next, we have someone else to talk with. This is someone in Philo, line number 2. Hello.
Did you ever hear that boron added to a diet will stimulate osteoporosis prevention?
Well, boron is, I don't remember exactly what the actual studies have shown about that, but boron is one of those quote unquote rare minerals that we do get very small amounts in our diet, but I don't know of any studies off the top of my head that have shown that to be preventative. One of the problems is, like, for instance, fluoride. It actually, if you give patients reasonable doses of fluoride, you can make that bone density go way up in fairly short amount of time. And fluoride's a very inexpensive medicine. Unfortunately, the trials showed that the quality of the bone was not good, and that in fact you made the bones denser, thicker, which should be protective, but the bones more easily fractured. So you were actually doing more harm than good. So getting a quick fix for our bones is not necessarily easy, but one good place we can all start in our youth is to lay down a proper amount of bone. And that's why good nutrition and proper calcium and vitamin D intake is so important as we're laying down bone for our teenagers and young adults.
In swine production, which of course is not mankind, but a small amount of boron in the diet causes a tremendous increase in density of the bone.
Interesting. Thanks.
All right. Well,
I'll look it up. See if it's been tried in humans.
We have time certainly for other callers as well. And the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me sneak a quick question here about calcium supplementation, because I think that there still seems to be some sort of debate about if you're going to take calcium. Obviously, nutritionists would say what we would want you to do is we want you to get it in your diet. So drink milk, eat yogurt, have leafy green vegetables, you know, do those things that eat those things to have calcium. But if you can't get enough that way, okay, you can have a calcium supplement. But then the question is, what form of calcium? And there are different forms, and apparently different people think different kinds are better. What do you think?
And that is an excellent question, and my thinking has changed a little bit over time. And the products that are out there do vary. There are some that are synthetic. There are some natural products. For a fairly long time, we've wanted to stay away from the quote-unquote bone kinds of products that came from, say, horses and so forth, because we found out that some of them were actually contaminated with leads and various things and actually were fairly unsafe. We also know that in certain foods that citric, for instance, if you take your calcium with orange juice, it's supposed to enhance absorption. But then recent data with the actual citrated products don't show quite the same natural calcium release. I think the quick answer is going to be that most physicians are going to say they're all good and get a product that is tolerable for you and take it in a reasonable sequence in your diet. If you want to get down to some of the fine points for certain individuals who are having trouble with absorption or trouble with getting their calcium in, you can. But also you can use blood testing to make sure that those calcium levels are reasonable. And in our community, getting blood testing for vitamin D levels is also potentially important, as when I run research studies, I'll get 10 to 15% of my patients that just sort of off the street present to participate in basic research protocols that'll have vitamin D levels that are considered inadequate. Now, of course, there's some argument amongst experts as to what level's inadequate for vitamin D. There's some disagreement about the lab test. But also, you don't, for instance, want to take those bisphosphonates at the same time you take your calcium, because that's going to compromise the absorption. It's true for other medicines as well. If you take your calcium in divided up doses, it's going to be a little bit better. A lot of people get concerned that if they take calcium supplementation, they're going to overdo calcium. But it's really hard to do that. You have to take such tremendous amounts. I've never heard of a patient taking enough to cause a problem that way. So a lot is probably individual patient management. What I tell the average patient is to think about your daily nutrition, and on your high nutrient days, maybe you're not going to need so much in the way of vitamins and supplementation. And on your low nutrient days, you're going to need a lot more. Omega-3 fatty acids and some of the antioxidants, particularly those that we get from the fish oils, are really hard to get in your diet. And probably most people need supplementation with that. And actually, just in the past couple of months, there was a prescription vitamin release, which we've really not had basic prescription vitamins other than, say, for a particular nutrient like iron. That has not been available. It's studied this particular product, and can't even remember the name of the product, so I can't promote the product, but this particular product has had some good research behind it regarding what level of the fish oil supplementation do you need. But still, when you read the side of the box, it's not going to necessarily have all the nutrients that you might want your patient to get. It might not have enough calcium. Again, when you're taking vitamins, I think it's a good idea to share that information with your healthcare provider, whatever you're doing nutrient-wise, and then you can sit down, read those packages, and try to figure out, okay, for my case, how much calcium do I need? Does this supplementation and my diet provide an adequate amount? And if not, do I need to increase the amount? Do I need to change the type? And that's pretty much how I deal with it. Some people have a lot of problems with constipation with calcium. And since we have so many patients that have dyspepsia or irritable bowel, getting too constipated from too much calcium can be a problem. So trying to get those patients to back off on supplementation and, again, go back to getting their nutrients out of food is sometimes really important.
Yeah, I think one of the other questions that sometimes comes up when you talk about calcium supplementations is stone formation. And people say,
and
is that
you have
increase
to get
my risk
way
of kidney
too
stone?
Much in. Yeah,
okay, so it's
like 4.5 grams, something like that, increases your risk of stone formation. And even a patient with osteoporosis, we recommend 1.5 grams. So it would be really, you'd be eating an awful lot of calories on top of your supplements to get to a dangerous calcium level. But we know that calcium supplementation is probably also beneficial for heart disease and blood pressure reduction. So there are other benefits. We've studied it actually even in pregnant women to see if it reduces their risk of elevated blood pressure. And it was actually, there was a study in Ecuador that showed that helped a lot. We haven't really gotten quite the same information in the American studies. But in general, it's a very important nutrient, and definitely everyone, men and women, should be getting enough calcium.
And we got about maybe 3-4 minutes left, and we have no call. Is there anything in particular that you would like
well,
to talk about?
Another thing I was going to say, the person that called about the osteonecrosis, and I was going to point out, and I think I did point out, that most of the reports are with the intravenous form, and we do now have a new release product called Beneva that can be given intravenously to protect against osteoporosis, and it's very useful for people who have GI or esophageal disease and cannot swallow bisphosphonate and aren't candidates for alternatives.
All right. Let's talk with another caller here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Regarding the recent tragedy with the trials of the new drug, I don't understand why they didn't give them a smaller portion to start and then maybe gradually increase the dosage. Your reply, please.
Well, all those protocols before they are undertaken, they undergo a fairly rigorous process of phase one, phase two, phase three, where dosing is established and effectiveness is then looked at, and then wider population looked at. And all of that is submitted to the FDA, and groups of scientists do evaluate all these protocols fairly extensively, but studies are in fact done to establish what is going to be both effective and safe for patients. And that's why we do clinical trials and welcome patient participation in them.
That's one of the facts of life, I guess, of developing new medications, is that you can do a lot of studies beforehand. You can do studies using animals as subjects, but eventually you're going to have to give it to some people to find out
happens. We have talked about this before. When we do clinical research trials, the FDA will need to see a fairly clean set of data. And in order to do that, we're fairly strict with patients. But we will do anything to accommodate. We have patients where, to keep them in trials, we've been involved in trials that are going on worldwide. And some patients, they move to the United States and they get transferred to your site to be followed. So really, I think the drug companies do a tremendous job of trying to be as inclusive as possible and follow up with their patients. But once a medication is released, there's both on-label and off-label use by individual physicians. There are patients with other kinds of conditions who might not have been allowed in the trial that are now taking medications. And it is a difficult problem. But fortunately, we've had many, many safe drugs that have made healthcare extremely better than it was in the past.
Any last little thing you might like to talk about?
Well, I think in terms of trials, the most exciting information that's going to be coming out soon is on the HPV vaccination. And since the FDA released the HPV testing as primary cancer screening for women ages 30 and over, I do encourage patients to get that test and find out their risk factors for HPV and to learn about it, as it's a very exciting development for the protection of women against cervical cancer and cervical disease.
So that's the human papilloma virus, which is thought.
Correct.
Some of them, there are a bunch of them, but apparently some of them in particular are thought to be related to cervical cancer.
Yes, they are.
So if we could deal with just those handful, there are, I don't know.
HPV 16 and 18 are probably responsible for 70 to 80% of all cervical cancer and high grade cervical disease in the world. So those two in particular, and 6 and 11, are responsible for many abnormal Pap smears. So some of the vaccinations that have been written, the Gardasil vaccine that's being written up quite a bit, do target those four HPV. Viruses to be prevented against.
Yeah, so
it's very exciting.
The point will come when that would be a standard recommendation for young women at the point where they were about to, we think they were about to become sexually active?
Well, I think that in order to protect the vast majority of patients in our population, that it definitely should be a consideration. And I think in one of the early March issues of the New Yorker magazine, they talked about some of the political implications of this vaccine and other medications and vaccines in general. That was pretty good if you'd like to read about the political side of it. But this vaccine will be accepted a little bit differently than other vaccines, and we need to do more work on it because we won't have as long follow-up as we have with some of the other vaccines available. But it's a very exciting development, and worldwide, something like 500,000 women worldwide contract cervical cancer each year. So it's going to be tremendous health impact immediately.
All right. Well, Dr. Suzanne Truppen, she's an obstetrician and gynecologist with a practice here in our area. She also teaches at the U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign. We're now going to an every other month schedule with her, and we're going to on the other shows continue to do other health topics. So that means we will see you, I think, next in May.
Sounds
right?
Good.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.